passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Are you looking to upgrade your game on and off the field? Triple Crown Jewelry makes the cleanest jewelry in the game so you can show your style. Their jewelry is made by athletes for athletes with durability and style in mind. They make the best-selling number pendants and chains that you're already seeing on the field. Whether your style is gold, matte black, or silver, Triple Crown Jewelry has what you need. Personally, I'm more about the silver, but Triple Crown is ready for whatever your style. The chains look great. They're durable with a shine that stands out, and when you put it on, it has a nice heft to it. You can feel the quality. Your number is yours. It's part of your identity, and Triple Crown knows that. They have numbers from 00 to 99 available, so you can show your number, your identity, on and off the field. Their jewelry will never turn your neck green or fade. They're tarnish resistant and made to last. These aren't just accessories. They're a statement of your dedication and love for the game. And that shine is unmatched. And in addition to choosing between the three different finishes, you can also choose from a variety of chains, including rope, Franco, and Cuban chains. So try it yourself. If you're ready to elevate your drip on and off the field, get some new drip at triplecrownjewelry.com and get a special discount just for our listeners. Get 25% off your first order site-wide with promo code BA2022. That's BA2022 at triplecrownjewelry.com. And by doing so, you're supporting our podcast. Orders are shipped the same or next business day from New Jersey, and orders over $50 get free shipping. Don't miss out on the opportunity to make a statement both on and off the field. Go to triplecrownjewelry.com and lead the league in drip.
Welcome to the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me, as always, is my colleague, Joe Healy. And Joe, the calendar, it is flipping to May. I don't know if we really feel like it's May, if we feel like it's still March, time these days, but it does keep marching, and we have made it to May.
Yeah, Selection Monday, just a few weeks away, which sounds really haunting when I say it like that. I heard someone say something the other day that seems right, which is, you know, I think we all remember how long March felt, which is funny because we really got like a third of March out of the way without incident, you know, at least in terms of this new normal we have going on now. But March dragged on for so long, and now I feel like April went by fairly quickly. And I saw somebody say that the days feel like weeks and the weeks feel like days. And like, strangely, I think that's about right, where some of the individual days can kind of drag, especially when you've been taken. I find that to actually be the case a little bit more on the weekends, where we're used to filling our weekends, you and I specifically, with going to games, covering games. And even for folks who don't do this professionally, they're used to filling their weekends in a lot of cases with sports content, whether this time of year that's NBA, NHL playoffs, baseball, what have you. And that's been taken away. It kind of throws that into disarray. So some of the individual days can feel kind of lengthy, but the weeks have been going by fairly quickly, at least in my estimation.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Although at the same time, I have no idea because, again, what is time? But if you are looking to fill your abundant time with some of that sports content that we're missing out on, Joe and I are the place to go here on the Baseball America College Podcast, because today we are continuing our series of rewatching, or I guess in a lot of cases watching, classic college games that we can find over on YouTube, and then we come back here and we break them down with a guest who is a part of that game. And so today we are talking about the 2011 College World Series matchup between Virginia and South Carolina. It is the game that sent South Carolina to the finals for the second consecutive year. And we will be joined by former Gamecocks ace Michael Roth. He started this game for South Carolina. Did not finish it because it went pretty deep into extra innings. But he pulled in a great start, and the game was an excellent game between these two programs. The second time they met in Omaha, it was an interesting one to look back on. Obviously, knowing what we know about the South Carolina dynasty at the start of this decade, and just kind of interesting to look back on. It's the first year that they're in TD Ameritrade Park. You have a returning national, defending national champion in this case, and a lot of premium talent on the field. So that's what we have on tap for you today, Joe. It was an interesting look back, I thought, to this one.
I thought so too. I mean, I've been touting it in the last couple of podcast episodes as like a nice snapshot in time of what college baseball was like at the time. And actually, it was even more so than I thought. I kind of thought it's going to be nice to see the South Carolina team again, like quite literally smack in the middle of what turned out to be a 22-game postseason winning streak, which is just absurd to say out loud. And it was that was nice. It was kind of nice to spend some time with that team again. It was also kind of nice to see that Virginia program, which had been building, really kind of cooking at that point and was on the way to winning a national title a few years later. But there were other things around that. And you know, like you mentioned, first year of TD Ameritrade, that was kind of fun to see and realize that was the first year. And I can even sense maybe this is – maybe I'm wrong about this, but I also sense – because it was the first year of TD Ameritrade, you saw some things in the game presentation that I don't recall hearing much. And like they were doing like, like charge chants, that kind of stuff over the sound system. And I don't really recall them doing that kind of thing at TD Ameritrade now. Maybe they do, but I don't recall that. And so I wonder if they were just trying to kind of play with the format a little bit more than they had in previous years at Rosenblatt. Again, I could be wrong about that, but it's just something that drew my attention because I was trying to think about this being the first year of TD Ameritrade. It was also the first year of the BB Corp bats. And boy, am I glad that, you know, we've kind of got the equipment right in college baseball, because one thing I do remember about this period of time is I just remember thinking that, you know, walks are essentially inexcusable in college baseball during this era, because the only way people were putting up runs in bunches was if you threw the ball around or if you walked people. Pitchers could just really without fear throw the ball over the plate, especially in TD Ameritrade, because you weren't likely to get burned. Occasionally you would, but not very likely. And you can see it in games in this era that outfielders are playing at essentially medium depth, because the strategy was take away any cheap singles. And on the lack of a risk that you're going to get burned for an extra base hit. And most of the time that paid off. So anyway, I say all that to say, it was even a better snapshot of a moment in time in college baseball history than I even realized going into it.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting look back into the vault. It's not as far back as we went a week ago when we went all the way back to 92 to see Pepperdine. But it is a different era of college baseball all the same. And so that's part of what makes this so interesting, is that it feels like it was a really long time ago if you're, you know, just looking over the course of time or over the course of the changes in the game in the last decade. But it was, you know, less than a decade ago, actually. So I thought that was interesting. Michael Roth is one of the more interesting characters in the game in the last decade, one of the constants throughout the South Carolina run. He's a part of all three of these College World Series teams. And, you know, just we put him on the cover of the college preview issue one year. He reached the big leagues. He was never like a premium prospect, but he was just this great college player. And so it's interesting to, you know, go back and take this trip with him down memory lane and to see how he viewed the game then and how he reflects on it now. So I thought all of that was pretty great. Spoiler alert, we already did the interview. So with that, I guess let's get to Michael Roth. the South Carolina ace. And let's go back to a day in June in Omaha in 2011. Today on the Baseball America College Podcast, we are excited to welcome in former South Carolina ace and big leaguer Michael Roth, star of those great Gamecocks teams. Michael, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, hanging out at the house right now, just amid this virus mess that we're all dealing with here.
Absolutely. It is quite the mess. But we wanted to take a trip down memory lane to 2011. And, of course, that's an exciting year in South Carolina baseball history and, in the midst of this dynasty at the start of the last decade. And, when we set the scene here, the game that we're talking about is the second time you guys had played Virginia in the College World Series. You guys had so much success to this point over the last couple years, even. What did it feel like in terms of just the postseason, the confidence you guys were playing with? It must have felt like you guys were unbeatable at times.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, in 2011, obviously most of the team had been to the College World Series before, in the previous year. And we were kind of the underdogs, or at least we played that card and obviously went on to win. And then in 2011, we just had such a strong, we had the majority of the guys back and had just such a strong group of guys that were just mentally tough. And not that we were, I don't want to say, arrogant, but we were just very confident that we, had every ability to walk into a game and go ahead and win it, no matter who we were playing. And, Virginia had some really good arms and some really good teams. And, we, up until that point, were just kind of on a roll and had faced a lot of good teams. We look at what we did to get there in 2011 was we had to go through a solid UConn team, and then made it to the World Series and beat Florida. Or wait, that was, I think that was 2000. Yeah, we had to beat, we beat Florida on the opening game, and then here we are facing Virginia.
You mentioned the lead up to getting to that World Series. You took on UConn, and that was a really good UConn team that included George Springer and Nick Ahmed. They ended up with four big leaguers on that team, and it strikes me that's a team that if they'd have faced just about anybody but maybe you guys, that team ends up in Omaha. What do you remember about competing against that group in that Super Regional?
Honestly, I don't really remember much. It's probably terrible to say, but what I do remember was I remember that they came, that they were highly touted, and I think they were playing at Clemson. And so they were in Clemson's regional. And so at one point, we thought we were going to have a super regional showdown against our rivals. And I believe UConn went in there and beat Clemson in the final game, or won two in a row and then came to play us. And I just remember, I knew they were a solid team. Obviously, if you make it to the Super Regionals, you're a great team. In 2010, we played the Coastal, and that was probably one of the best teams we played in 2010, and even including the College World Series. And, we were able to advance against them. But when I just do remember that they had a lot of great, great guys. I always forget about Ahmed, but, I knew about Barnes and Springer, obviously, who was probably one of their standout players that year.
So you get back to Omaha, and just what is the difference in being in Omaha, having been there before and going in as the champs? How different was the feeling among the team? You talked about how there are a lot of guys back, a lot of guys had experienced that. What was your guys' experience having been there and done that before?
Well, in 2011, it was a new experience in the sense that you're playing at a different stadium. It was new for really everyone that was there. The stadium was brand new. Things around the stadium were completely different. So not only the players were adjusting to new experiences, but also the fans. And, you know, Rosenblatt was around the stadium. Rosenblatt was just a massive party. They'd have the beer gardens. You could just walk around, and it was an awesome atmosphere. And in 2011, you know, everybody was still trying to figure out what the area was like, and it still wasn't, some of the development around TD Ameritrade wasn't finished. But for us, as far as playing in games, you know, we had played in big games. We had played in big games in 2010, and we had played in big games in 2011. And so we were just very, I guess I would just say that mentally strong, and that was driven, the mental strength that was driven into us, you know, prepared us for going into a new environment, although, you know, maybe not new in just the level and intensity of games. And, but we also knew that while we had all this experience, we also on paper weren't the best team. And it was always, you know, we were going against a Florida team who had tons of guys that had been drafted. Or we were going against a guy like Danny Holton, who I think struck out 8 out of the first 9 guys when he faced us. You know, guys on paper that almost on, you know, if back then, if you looked at it on paper, we were always probably the lesser team. And so I think some of that attitude with just our confidence in ourselves helped us be, you know, be a great team and put together some wins.
Let's move into this actual game here. So in the second inning, is you hit a little bit of a jam. They get a leadoff walk, and then a single puts guys on first and third, and you're able to get out of it with the help of a double play. How much of a boost was that for you to kind of keep things from snowballing early on against a Virginia team that was really, really good, as you mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the big thing for being a left-handed pitcher and a guy like myself where I just got a lot of ground balls was I always knew I was a pitch away. If I had a man on first and one out, I was always a pitch away from getting out of the inning. And that's kind of how I always viewed it in my entire baseball career, was that, you know, as long as I could get a ground ball, I'm, you know, normally had guys up the middle or around me that could field it enough to bail me out. And that's what I feel like you have to do as a pitcher. You know, if you limit the self-inflicted damage of like walks and hitting people, and you just let your guys play behind you, a lot of times you can let hitters get themselves out.
This game obviously is happening in late June. You've thrown a lot of innings by now. This will ultimately be the 14th time you went at least 7 innings in a game. How are you feeling physically while this is going on, and how did you stay sharp, you know, throughout this long extended season?
Yeah, that was, you know, something about being a starter just clicked with me. I just really enjoyed the ability to kind of put the team on your back and get into those later innings. I always viewed it as my game, and, you know, that meant my game to win and my game to lose. And so, you know, going into the season, whether it was, you know, even when I was a reliever, going into the season as a junior or senior, even when I was a sophomore in 2010, I was going in and preparing to throw as much as I could. And I was, you know, I've never been a huge fan of pitch counts, especially as you get older into, and let me clarify, when I say older, I mean like you've, you know, reached puberty and everything. And I mean pitch counts as in not going above like something crazy, like 150 or something. But, you know, I felt like in a lot of my innings there throughout the whole year in 2011, there's a difference between like high pressure situations where you're pitching with men on base and you're cruising. And there's some games where, you know, I may have thrown 90 pitches and, you know, 60 of those 90 pitches were, you know, with men on base and in high pressure situations where it's taking a lot more out of your body and your arm and just your mentality. And then there's other games where, you know, I could have thrown 105 pitches and I was just cruising. And so there wasn't a whole lot of taxing on my, you know, on my body and mentally as well. And so I always put a lot of work in prior, and college baseball is a little bit different where you get to throw once a week. So there's a lot of time in between there. And I spent a lot of time in the training room with Brainerd Cooper, and spent a lot of time in the weight room with Billy, just always trying to push myself to, one, recover quicker. So that way, you know, I knew when we would go into the playoffs, I would pitch on 3 and 4 days rest. And I think that's what helped me do what I was able to do in 2010, 11, and 12.
You mentioned earlier that this was the first year of TD Ameritrade Park in Omaha. It was also the first year of the BB Corps bat change before they had changed the ball. As a result, offense was just down across college baseball in general. And I'm wondering if you can give us a sense from having competed in that environment. I mean, how much more precious did it make runs feel in general, or you know, even just trying to string hits together, you know, as you went through this postseason? I imagine it was a situation where one or two runs could ultimately feel like 10 runs, just given that you knew you weren't likely to be able to put up these big 5, 6, 7 run innings just in a moment's notice.
Yeah, it was a big difference, you know, with the BB Corps bats, and obviously I was still hitting here and there at that point, and you know, I remember what it was like hitting with those trampoline-like bats my freshman year in 2009 and 10 versus the BB Corps bats, and it was a big difference. I think it was also just a big psychological difference. For pitchers and hitters, and for pitchers in the sense that you're able to – you may have a little more faith and a little more and so you're willing to throw that fastball over the plate and just be more intent on throwing a strike. And I would say probably the biggest difference was just you knew that if it was over the plate and they hit it, they really had to get a hold of it in order to get it out of TD Ameritrade. I mean, it, Rosenblatt won with the old bats, it flew out of that park, but TD Ameritrade, it was a much bigger park. The wind wasn't built up on a hill like Rosenblatt, and so there wasn't a whole lot of wind in the area. And so the ball, I mean, I can just remember some balls that were absolutely smashed that didn't go anywhere. And I think in 2011, we only hit one home run, and it was by Peter Mooney, our shortstop, at the very last game. And so for me as a pitcher, I just viewed it as, you know, use it to my advantage, be aggressive over the plate. And, you know, in knowing that if I didn't make a great, those guys were going to have to really get a hold of it to get one out of the park. And if it wasn't out of the park, then, you know, my guys had a chance to go run it down, or I had a chance to get out of the inning by, you know, trying to make some better pitches.
So you exit the game, and eventually Matt Price comes in, and he doesn't leave the game for a long time. He threw, I think it was 90 plus pitches in relief. What's that like watching him come on and do his thing, and just how much confidence did everyone have when he took the mound?
Well, the role of a closer in college, at least when I was playing, is not like the role of a closer in professional baseball. And that's what made Matt so good was, you know, he pitched like a closer with all the emotion and all the energy that he brought. That's what he fed on, was just that intensity. And especially in this game, you know, in the Virginia game, it felt like at times he would almost put people on base so that way he could get fired up to get guys out. But, you know, we knew Matt was just so good, and we, you know, we could tell, and I think you can tell in this game when there's times when, you know, when he wasn't able to feed off that energy. But we just knew that if it was in Matt's hands, we had the ability to win the game. You never want your closer to go that long, obviously. And for Matt, I'm sure it felt like he was a starter, you know, and at some point, I think it almost was like I didn't even pitch because that game went so long. But we just had a ton of faith in Matt and his ability, because he was so good at the end of games and so good when the pressure was on.
one moment when we certainly did see the emotion from Matt Price is in the 13th when Virginia has a couple guys on and Scott Wingo starts a line drive double play on a ball headed up the middle. He snags it, tosses it, and gets the double play at second base. How much of an emotional lift did that provide? Sometimes in these games that kind of go on forever, you hit little natural lulls in energy and sharpness. And I'm curious if that kind of helped you guys, you know, I don't want to say wake up, but kind of, you know, gave you guys the momentum you needed to go in the bottom half of the inning and then win it.
Oh yeah, no doubt. I mean, you go into a game like that and you get put in a situation and whenever you get put in a situation like that, where there's men on base and there's ability for them to scratch a run, you start to question, man, are we going to be able to pull this off? Are we going to be able to get out of this? How are we going to do this? And for Matt to get that double play, one, you know, you just always see Scott and Peter, those guys in the middle, they just always made great plays. But two, in a moment like that, where it keeps the game in line for us to be able to go and win it, I mean, it gives you a ton of momentum. And there's a lot of momentum in baseball. You try not to ride those emotional waves, but it definitely happens in the game. And if you're a closer like Matt, you're definitely going to feel that. And all the other guys that are on the bench feel that too, and try to get the guys going to score some as you come in there.
So you guys will score in that 13th inning, and it happened partially because of some miscues from Virginia. But how much is that just you guys putting pressure on them and the way that you guys wanted to attack teams that to force some of those mental lapses? Or is it maybe just some experience that you guys had with an older experience group in with the Omaha, you know, experience from last year?
Yeah, I'd say Virginia was such a good team. And, you know, whenever you're playing extra innings, each inning that you go deeper into that, it just – the pressure ramps up a little bit more. The emotion starts riding a little bit more. And so it keeps going up a notch. And every little thing becomes a big thing. And we had been in that situation a number of times, and I think the team at that point that makes the least mistakes is who's going to win the game. And fortunately for us, we had been there, and we just didn't make that many mistakes as we got into later parts of the game throughout 2011, and specifically in this game. And we put some pressure on them in that inning. I think there was like a stolen base and then an overthrow. But yeah, I mean, we were just able to, you know, we were just fortunate enough not to make any mistakes where Virginia did, and that's where we were able to scratch a run across.
You touched on this a little bit earlier, but the path you guys had in Omaha was not easy after A&M, which was a good team in its own right that year. I mean, you have Virginia twice, the number one team in the country, and then to finish it off, you have to go through Florida a couple times, and that was a stacked team as well. What does it say about that group that you were able to take down those types of teams in four consecutive games against Virginia and Florida to get the job done?
Yeah, I mean, you know, whenever you get to Omaha, you're playing the best teams in baseball. And that Texas A&M game was a wild start to the year to Omaha, because you know, we gave up four in the first, and then we answered it, and then it was basically a 0-0 ball game until the bottom of the ninth. And so you're playing those tight games throughout, and you just, you know, for us, we hadn't played those guys yet, so we don't know much about them. We're relying on scouting reports. But you know, when we go into the finals and we're playing Florida, we'd obviously seen those guys a bunch. You know, I think in 2011, they had actually dogpiled on our field to win the SEC title. And so there was a little bit – or maybe that was 10. I'm mixing the years up. But, you know, we had known those Florida guys a good bit. And so going into the finals, you know, we knew those guys. Whereas going in playing Virginia and Texas A&M, you know, we hadn't faced those guys before. But you obviously know that if you get to Omaha, you're a great team. and a great program.
So this obviously goes into, you know, the lore of your career and the South Carolina run in Omaha there. When you look back at that, is it possible for you to like create even a favorite moments list, or are there just too many memories from that time for you to even like accurately try and start lining things up in terms of what you remember the most fondly?
There's a ton of memories, you know, on the field and off the field. And probably the biggest one, just for me personally, which really just put me in a position to further my career, you know, individually, but also that just helped us, you know, advance in the Colorado Series, was my, when they gave me the opportunity to start against Clemson in 2010. That, you know, that decision right there, and the way that I was able to go out there and perform that game, changed really the course of my career. You know, because up until that point, I hadn't really started many, games. I'd started two games of four, and I'd really only thrown a couple innings in each one. So that opportunity just changed the course of my career. But I mean, that Clemson game, you know, winning the first World Series in 2010. Just all the trips, all the big games that we were able to play, all the battles, you know, when we, you know, we're playing against like Sonny Gray and, you know, the guys that are at Florida, and there's just a number of teams that we played that were just so good. And you look back on some of the guys that we even had on our own team, like what Witt's doing in professional baseball right now. And same with Christian Walker and Jackie Bradley, you see what these guys are doing. And it's just, it's a lot of fun. And it's really cool that we had such a good run.
I wanted to ask you about something a little bit different, and that's your involvement with Great Britain on the international stage. You pitched for them a number of different international competitions. And I'm curious what that experience has been like for you. It's a little bit different than pitching in the SEC or pitching in Omaha. So I'm curious if you could take us through your involvement there and what you make of Great Britain kind of trying to evolve a little bit as a baseball country.
Yeah, no doubt. So my mom was born in Kettering, in the UK. And so that gives me British citizenship. So, and I didn't really know that until 2012. And part of that, Great Britain reached out to me. People with the British Baseball Federation reached out to me, kind of letting me know that I could play for them in 2012. And there was a qualifier coming up that year. So I was playing professionally, I'd been drafted with the Angels, and so I was in Orem, Utah for short season, and there was a qualifier coming up in Germany, and so I got approval from the Angels to go play, and so that was my first time I was able to go play for Great Britain. And we went, you know, I didn't know what to expect. I had no clue. I knew that I was not necessarily in the best of shape, because I'd thrown like 140 innings in college. When I was in pro ball, they were only letting me throw two innings, you know, every 5 days, which that's when I really hated professional baseball, because I couldn't pitch. But and so we got there, and we were in Regensburg, Germany, and it was a ton of fun. You know, one of the first things we did was we got all the guys together and just went through and, you know, tried to understand, hey, where's your, you know, why are you here? What's your connection to Great Britain? You know, because some of them were guys like me, plastic Brits, who, you know, where parents were, you know, born there, and we've never lived there. You know, or mostly we would probably consider ourselves American, but our heritage is in Great Britain. So, connecting with just a bunch of different guys, that was a ton of fun. We didn't do very well, but then we made it to, we had the qualifier in 2016, and, you know, we had a really good run. We just lost to Team Israel, and they were, you know, they did a good job in 2017, where they went and played pretty well. So losing to them, I think Marquee threw against us twice. And, you know, you got a guy who's got a ton of big league experience versus us who, you know, we had some guys on the field that weren't even, you know, I think the guy that we started in that game, in the final game, was a PE teacher. so you know, the difference in just some of the lineups, you know, obviously just a drastic difference. One guy's a professional baseball player. The other guy is doing it for fun. And but it's just a great group of guys. You know, I was fortunate enough to play with them actually last year in 2019 at the European Championship. And that was part of the path to try to qualify for the Olympics. And again, you know, just we played some really good teams, like Team Germany with Donald Lutz on it. We lost 1-0 to them. I think I threw 8 innings that game. And then we had, you know, the European tournaments are a lot different because there's really no pitch counts. When you're playing in the WBC qualifiers, there's all pitch counts, and MLB mandates these rules. Whereas in the European tournament, I think I threw 8 and like 4 and then 5. So I threw a bunch of innings in like 6 days. But it's a lot of fun. You're playing one, you know, a lot of times is in different country. Again, this one this past year was in Germany. In the 2012 qualifier was in Germany. 2016 was in Brooklyn. So you get to play in some really cool places. You get to play with some guys that you wouldn't normally play with. And playing for, you know, a flag is a lot different than playing for, you know, a team that pays you. So it's really cool. You're coming together and you're trying to come together for a brief amount of time. You know, tournament baseball is drastically different than professional in college, where you've got time to nurture a team and a culture. Whereas in tournament baseball, you're just coming together and try to come together for a week and see how good you can play. But it's been a ton of fun. I got to give a huge shout out to Liam Carroll for, you know, really pushing the envelope for Great Britain baseball. I mean, he does so much work, to really further the cause for the national teams. He, you know, so much of what he does not get paid for. And baseball in Great Britain's not, you know, not the number one thing by any means. Soccer obviously dominates over there. And it will be a hard fight for baseball to, you know, to keep pushing, but there's some really good players that I got to play with last year that are in college. Richard Brereton would be one who's at Emory. I mean, and he's, you know, I think he was 20 years old and has a ton of ability. He was just coming off a great season at the Cape, and he's a guy that was playing for Great Britain, and hopefully he's got several years ahead of him. And you know, I think I would be surprised if he doesn't have a professional career in there as well.
So the British team, I guess, is the only baseball you really did last year. I don't want to say retired because you haven't really retired, but you've been out of pro ball since the end of 18. What kind of more occupies your day-to-day in these times after the pro career has come to a close?
Yeah. So my last, you know, bit of professional baseball really was down in the Dominican. I went down and played in the fall of 2018. You know, in 2018, I was with the Cubs, got traded to the Rangers, and then was dealing with like a knee issue at the end, and went down to the Dominican. And that was just, you know, every time I had been down the Dominican, I fell in love with baseball again. And when I went down in fall of 2018, I was just so tired, I think. And I just was kind of tired of baseball and ready to be back home with my wife and my dog. And so that's what I'm doing now, you know, I'm living in Greenville now, Greenville, South Carolina. I started getting into commercial real estate investing in brokerage in the off season, back in 2016. So that's what occupies, you know, most of my days, just looking for opportunities and just helping businessmen, you know, business leaders, and entrepreneurs and invest in commercial real estate. And that's kind of my gig now. I was actually supposed to play for Great Britain, had a qualifier coming up in March that, was canceled about 4 days before all the flights were heading out there. And heading out to Phoenix for this virus head. So not sure, you know, obviously MLB is trying to figure out what they're going to do with the season before they can even figure out what they're going to do with the World Baseball Classic coming up next year. So that impacts the qualifiers, but not sure when I'll, you know, if I'll be able to play in the next one or the next qualifier, but we'll see. But, you know, not that I'm trying to stay in shape to make a comeback by any means. It's always fun to go play for Great Britain, and, you know, it would be fun to go out there and play again.
Well, hopefully we're able to get a return to that soon enough, and we can get a WBC or get another round of Olympic qualifying or whatever it is. Hopefully the baseball comes back soon enough. But Michael, we really appreciate you taking the time here to join us on the Baseball America College podcast and, you know, take a trip down memory lane to this 2011 College World Series.
Yes, no problem. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you again to former Gamecocks ace Michael Roth for joining us here on the Baseball America College podcast. Joe, that game, you know, we talked about it being a fun look into the vault, into what college baseball was a decade ago. And, you know, one of the things that stood out to me just was how much talent was on the field. You know, we think about the Virginia teams, I think, a little more that actually won the national title or played for the national title in those back-to-back seasons. But this Virginia team was loaded. That South Carolina team is full of stars in its own right, obviously. You have Jackie Bradley Jr. You know, you have college stars like Michael Roth. There's just a ton of talent on the field. And this game really kind of lived up to that kind of billing.
Yeah, no doubt. And what's funny about these South Carolina teams to me, and this is a me, like I'm fully admitting this is a me thing, but I actually don't associate Jackie Bradley Jr. as strongly with these teams as I do Michael Roth and Matt Price. And some of that is because I'm coming at it from the standpoint of being a college baseball guy. And so that's why that is. I'm not suggesting that that should be the case, but you would think that he would have an outsized level of importance on this team. And he was a big part of it. But I think that also speaks to how much of a, as much as it sounds like a cliche, how much of a true team this was. And it's amazing to me also the level to which, I mean, look, anytime you get to three straight national championship series and you win two of them, those teams are going to have cult heroes emerge. But there's just a really large group of cult heroes that came from these teams, Roth and Matt Price and Scott Wingo, certainly, even Mooney to a certain degree. There are a lot of guys that kind of became heroes as part of these South Carolina teams that went on this incredible run. And I don't know, without doing a thorough accounting of it, I don't really know that there's any other program that had having a run like this is just so difficult to do. But of those that have, I don't know that there's been a group that's had as many, you know, cult heroes, broadly defined as the type of player who excels more in college than in a professional career and kind of has this lore around them. South Carolina certainly has a lot, none greater than Michael Roth. That's kind of one of my big takeaways from it. The other thing that I, you know, had by looking at this box score, I didn't remember this actually from when I'd seen this game almost 10 years ago, but, you know, Danny Holtzen starts it. And when I looked at the box score, and you and I had this conversation leading up to us podcasting about it, like, why does Danny Holtzen come out early? And I thought maybe he is on short rest or something, maybe he has some sort of injury, and it wasn't really any of that. He was ill. And so I think what's interesting too is like just kind of the what if, like, because, you know, he leaves the game after three and South Carolina immediately puts two runs on the board. And that really ends up being largely the difference for much of that game. And you just wonder, now Danny Holtzen was not going to throw a, you know, 25 strikeout shutout, but he was really dealing on a day when his body was betraying him. And it does just kind of lead to a natural what if in an era when offense was at a premium, like Virginia scored an early run, would that run have held up? You know, I don't know. And we'll never know. And they still would have had to win one more game against South Carolina the next day to get to the finals. But it is like an interesting little what if situation in recent college baseball history for sure.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy when you're looking at this and you see the shots of Holtzen in the dugout, and they are legion. They were all about showing Danny Holtzen in the dugout that day. And he looks bad. Like, he is clearly suffering. And it's Omaha in June, and I didn't catch a game time temp, but I'm sure it was quite hot. But it's way more than that. And he's just out there on the mound, though, and he looks excellent. He looks so sharp. You know, he starts the game with six straight strikeouts. It's they weren't even fouling balls off. He's just literally unhittable. And that's everything that Danny Halston can be on the mound. After the game, Brian O'Connor gets on the podium and says, that's why the Mariners picked him second overall. And yeah, I mean, he looked the part very much that day. It's just very unfortunate that it wasn't his day overall. And it sounds like going into the game, they knew that he wasn't going to go much more than he went. They were maybe hoping to squeeze another inning out of him, according to what they're saying on the broadcast. But at no time did they think he was even going to go six or seven. That they understood he was going out there and he was going to give them all that he had, but that they were going to need guys behind him. And they have guys. They score on Kyle Crockett, but Kyle Crockett is a really good pitcher in his own right. At this time, he's just a freshman, but he'll go on to be a great closer for Virginia. And obviously, they have plenty of arms in that pen. It just, you kind of hurt for Halston and seeing what he's capable of and the fact that he is not capable of matching innings the way that he would want to.
And then, of course, the second half of this game really becomes a bullpen game. I mean, by virtue of Halston not lasting that long and by virtue of the fact that it goes 13. And, I mean, first of all, I guess kudos for Brandon Klein. I mean, he really matches Matt Price largely pitch for pitch and was really, really good and largely saves this game for Virginia. Not in the literal sense, but just in terms of things could have, snowballed on Virginia in a different scenario, but he comes in and settles things down. But Matt Price ends up kind of being the star of the show in a lot of ways. And when we were talking to Michael Roth, he talked about how, he thrived in those situations and specifically thrived in situations where he'd get himself in a jam. And it almost seemed like a game to him that he just wanted to see what kind of hot water he could get in just to see how close he could get to, how close he could get to getting scored on or not saving the game just to see if he could do it. And clearly that's not what's going on, but he sure does make it look like that at times. And that happened late in this game too. You start getting into extra innings and, Virginia's getting guys on and starting to put pressure on him. And sometimes he gets out of it with something like a strikeout. And then sometimes, like in the 13th inning, Virginia stings a line drive up the middle where if Scott Wingo is, playing a couple feet to his left or gets a late jump or any number of things, that ball goes up the middle and Virginia maybe gets that run there with a couple of guys on base. Instead, Wingo snags it, tosses it, to shortstop to get the double play on a line drive. But Price just kind of as like just kind of this Houdini act where he's able to get out of every last jam that he puts himself in. And I think that's why he has become, I mean, the production, of course, was there as well. But I think that's part of why he's such a big figure on these teams is there's just this kind of theatrical element to the way he pitched.
Yeah, I mean, it's remarkable. And when you look at all the times Virginia could have won this game and, just every single time South Carolina wriggles out of it. And I guess that's how you win 20 straight tournament games, 21 straight tournament games. That's how you win back-to-back national championships because you're getting the breaks and you're putting pressure on the opponent and taking advantage of your own, the breaks that you get. But yeah, I mean, just to see Virginia continue to put runners on and not be able to come up with a big hit. I mean, it must have been brutal to watch that in real time as a Hoos fan. And, I mean, it's a really good offense. Like, that's the other thing. Like, you're looking at this Virginia lineup. It's like, it's Chris Taylor, Steven Procia, Hicks, and just all up and down the lineup. There are good hitters in it throughout, and they're stymied by Price, by Roth, by anything that South Carolina is throwing at them. And it becomes, like so many extra inning games do, kind of a battle of the wills. But you know, like Roth saying, like you gotta find a way, and the way that they're out there putting pressure on their opponents, that you know, it kind of can wear on them at times.
Yeah, I think if this game was a little bit easier to watch from the standpoint of, you know, Virginia just coming up short time and again, it almost made me feel, I think seeing that could create a scenario where you start to really like feel for them in a way. It actually put me a little bit at ease that I know that, like, okay, you know, like a few years from now, don't get me wrong, it's not the same group of players, but a few years from now, like this program gets their national championship, and that made me feel a little bit better. And granted, they would have had to win a few more games after this one to even to have it happen in 2011. But that Virginia team was so good, to your point. And even with the, you know, taking a couple losses in Omaha to get eliminated, they finished the season 52-9. And for a team to lose less than 10 games all year and not win a national title, I mean, that's, they've got to be one of the better teams, at least in modern history, to not get that done. And so, but the idea that they come back a few years later and they get their trophy, even though, like I said, not the same group of guys, like it did kind of put me a little bit at ease, because otherwise, you're right, it is kind of just tough to watch over and over again that they were coming up short in situations where it felt like they were on the verge of putting a run across. But that's also what makes this game so good from the South Carolina standpoint, and also part of what makes what South Carolina was doing so impressive, because it wasn't like in this 22-game postseason winning streak, it wasn't like they were just mowing teams down. They had some of that, sure, but they were winning a lot of games like this. And that's, I think, part of what A, makes it impressive, but B, makes it, makes it something that couldn't ever be replicated, I don't think. I mean, you just need so much of a combination of talent and good fortune to be able to pull that kind of thing off. And so it's something I don't think we'll ever see again, that kind of streak, just because the bounces don't go your way sometimes. And in this game, and I'm sure there were several other examples during this run where South Carolina just got some bounces, the other team didn't, and that's how you end up winning 22 in a row.
I mean, it got hit on a little bit with Roth. He's talking about how good every team you're playing is, how good that Florida team was, and that Florida team, I mean, you look at the talent on that team that they're going to play in the finals. It was incredible as well. But, you know, you think about it, you're talking about how often do you not even lose 10 times in a year and don't win the national title? You're just that kind of gaudy record. Well, I mean, the year before, like Roth is mentioning, they beat Coastal. And 2010 Coastal is widely regarded as one of the best teams not to make it to the College World Series. And, Coastal goes out and gets their national title later as well. But that 2010 Coastal team is an incredible team. And South Carolina knocks them off. And just to be that kind of champion, you beating those kinds of teams to win two in a row of these, you gotta keep rolling through some of these big time win total teams and these all time great teams. And that's what the South Carolina team does under Ray Tanner for 2 years, and I mean kind of for three. Obviously they do come up short in 12, but it's only just short. And just the confidence that they have to be playing with is really impressive, that, you know, they absolutely just feel like they're unbeatable. And it seems like that they're certainly feeling that as well. And I guess if you're out there winning 20 straight NCAA tournament games, you deserve to feel like that.
I don't know if you had a similar feeling that I did. I know this is the first TD Ameritrade Park Omaha game that we have done in this series. I have that right, correct? We've done several Rosenblatt. True. Yeah. So because I never got to Rosenblatt, I didn't really necessarily – also, those old Rosenblatt games we've discussed were day games. There was something about watching this and it being a TD Ameritrade night game that made me kind of a little bit sad, the fact that we're not going to get that this year. I really haven't had to grapple with that a ton, I've had the thought and gone like, oh, well, that sucks. But like, I've never really had it hit me in the face that way. And it wasn't necessarily just the game and seeing the stadium, all of that contributed to it. It was just that I made a mental note, you know, that we were 2.5 hours on the YouTube version, which means we were closer to like 3 hours probably in terms of actual game time. And the sun was still kind of out a little bit. And those Omaha nights are long because, you know, they are on the kind of western edge of the central time zone. So it gets dark pretty late there. And something about just that late Omaha sunset and seeing that low light and something about all of that combined with a good game on the field, of course, just really started to make me feel a little bit sad that we're not going to get that this year. And I presume as we go through the rest of the offseason, there will be a number of moments like that. But this is the first time I've really had to grapple with it in that way.
Yeah, I won't say that I felt that way. And I think kind of because, yeah, it's the first time we're seeing TD Ameritrade and like it looks a little more like what we're used to, but it still felt very different. I feel like, you know, you look at the broadcast booth and it's Mike Patrick and Robin Ventura. Robin Ventura is presently a student assistant at Oklahoma State. Mike Patrick hasn't done the World Series and I don't know, 5, 8, I don't remember precisely when he stopped, but at least it's been more than 5 years.
Ventura managed the White Sox in between.
I had 1,000% forgotten that happened. You know, so that's going on there. Kyle Peterson's on the field as a sideline reporter. You know, the stadium, the way they're shooting in the stadium is a little different. They don't, you know, and One of the big things for me that kind of stood out is very early in the game, a beach ball comes out of the stands, as happens plenty of times over the course of the College World Series. And Jackie Bradley Jr. goes over and gets the beach ball and throws it back up. And today, anytime that happens, like the players are not getting that. The grounds crew is running out to get it. And they like stab the ball and like put it up as like a, essentially like a hunting display rack in like somewhere in the bullpen of all the beach balls they've like confiscated or whatever. Like, so just like a little thing like that, I was like, oh, things have changed in the last 10 years. They like really, yes, they're at TD Ameritrade, but they're just learning the park just like everybody else is.
Yeah. I think that's really interesting you say that because, so I was thinking about that. You've kind of led me back to the maybe a more well-rounded point of, that I was trying to make a little bit earlier with some of the sounds of TD Ameritrade Park being a little different is, you know, we'd have to have someone who went to both parks, you know, to cover games come on to kind of confirm that. But I think early on, and I remember this being a discussion when I was a fan back in 2011, for example, being part of the discussion of this was that initially, since there was so much apprehension about what they were losing by getting rid of Rosenblatt, you know, there was that community feel to the deal at Rosenblatt where people were parking cars in people's lawns and, you know, all that jazz. That I wonder if early on in TD Ameritrade, they were just trying to make it Rosenblatt, but over here, as opposed to now where it feels like, okay, this is different than what Rosenblatt was. And there's always going to be some people who think back wistfully about those days at Rosenblatt, and understandably and rightfully so. But now they're kind of just, this is different now. And this is its own thing. And now there's its own culture around TD Ameritrade Park now, and they're no longer trying to make it what it was in a nicer location. Now it's kind of developed its own feel, if you will.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And yeah, there are a couple like shots from outside the stadium and it doesn't look like the way it does now. And Michael Roth alluded to that, everyone was still just trying to figure it out. Whereas the previous year, you know, everyone talks about Rosenblatt being a block party, and it was that way. And then they moved downtown and it's not, the development isn't done yet. And no one knows what they're doing yet in terms of tailgating and the like. And so, yeah, I do not think we currently hear like Charge or any of the rest of that stuff piped in. You know, the one thing about TD Ameritrade that you may not realize if you're just watching it on TV, actually that you wouldn't realize if you're just watching it on TV, is that the press box, the windows don't open. It's almost entirely soundproof. They literally pipe in the crowd mic so that people in the press box can hear what's going on out there. So it, feels a little different sometimes. I don't mind it actually, but it does mean that sometimes it's a little sterile, and they, for all I know, they are playing charge calls, and it just totally is, my brain's not picking up on that. But I don't think they're doing that as much anymore. I have to imagine that, like, at this time they didn't have in-stadium hosts and like all sorts of stuff that they've now picked up on. And it's just very interesting that, like, to look at the first year of this and just see how much things have changed. And that's not the overarching point here, but you know, when you look back at the way that South Carolina straddles this, it's really impressive. This is not a unique point, but just that they win the last one in Rosenblatt, they win the first one in TD Ameritrade, they can win with the old bats, they win with the new bats. Like, nothing really seems to stop them, to slow them down at all, for the better part of 3 years here. And you know, just the way that South Carolina bridges the history of Omaha in the College World Series, these two very distinct eras, the Rosenblatt era and the start of the TD Ameritrade era, it's a very interesting, kind of trivial, but in other ways not trivial, because of what it says about the team, what it says about Ray Tanner, because there is so much returning talent. It's not like they just had two different teams and they happened to win in back-to-back years. No, there are a lot of these same players that are managing to do it at both ends. And it's just a unique position in history. And I think it's really cool that we have that, to bridge the two stadiums and what they represent in terms of the College World Series history.
Yeah, no, I don't think I have much to add there. I think that's well put. I think that is probably the best way to encapsulate why this era of South Carolina baseball, why these particular South Carolina teams are so important to the modern history of our sport. No, I think that's really well put.
You know, and I, in 2011, was an intern at Baseball America, actually. So I was around the office when this was happening. But, you know, there was I was doing a lot of like draft and minor stuff in addition to whatever college stuff I could take on. But I know I did not fully appreciate what South Carolina was doing at the time. And I don't know, I certainly have gained appreciation the more that I've looked back on it, but I certainly didn't appreciate it at the time. And I think that it's one thing to look at them. You know, a lot of people probably were able to grasp back-to-back titles, like how much that means, and like, okay, but it's a lot more than that, because, you know, Oregon State goes back-to-back. They're two totally different teams. They weren't really expected to do it. Not that South Carolina was favored to do it by any means, but they certainly were a much more prominent team and are doing it over these two different eras. And so it's much different when you look at them as a back-to-back champion than when you look at some of the other back-to-back champions in recent, you know, or teams that got close to being back-to-back champions in recent times. And I just think that is unique and is something to really acknowledge as being special, that what South Carolina was able to accomplish. And, you know, it truly was the glory days of South Carolina baseball. It's hard to imagine it ever getting that good again, not to say that they won't, or they can't win national titles again. I mean, I'm sure that they can, but to be that kind of team just feels like we aren't going to see that in college baseball, whether it's at South Carolina or anywhere. That might be something that we have to wait a very long time to see anywhere in the country.
Yeah, I think that's an important point to make. It's not a dig on South Carolina that they'll never be able to do this again. I just think, you know, like I said, whether it's the postseason winning streak or, you know, even getting to three CWS championship series in a row just seems so far-fetched given how competitive college baseball is and was back then too, by the way, which is the point we're making here, is that it was just so difficult to do what they did, and they really threaded the needle there. And it's hard to imagine anybody being able to catch lightning in a bottle in quite the same way again.
Shouts to Ray Tanner is the TLDR version of that. So with that, I think we're going to put a bow on this 2011 College World Series game. Definitely fun to look back on. Hopefully you guys all enjoyed the trip down memory lane with Michael Roth. Joe, why don't you tell the people what we are going to be doing next week if they want to watch along ahead of us, but to do their homework, I guess, as it were, before next week's podcast.
Yeah, we're going to be doing an all-SEC Super Regional, the 2018 Gainesville Super Regional between Florida and Auburn. It was obviously a big deal for Florida. I also think there's an interesting storyline here that I'm sure we'll mine, which is that the 2018 Super Regional and the way they lost that Super Regional ends up being something of a springboard for Auburn into 2019 and what they were able to accomplish then. So that's certainly something we'll talk about as well. But you know, Florida comes out ahead in this one. It's a good game. It's another extra inning game. Not quite as lengthy as the one we just watched. So, and certainly the game not being in Omaha will help probably be a little bit snappier, but it still is an extra inning game, but one that has a really dramatic ending. As I'm sure many of you recall that ending, but we'll go ahead and not spoil every last thing about the game in case you haven't seen it or haven't seen in a while. But it's a good one. Looking forward to talking about it. It will certainly be one that you and I will both have more firsthand memories of. So we'll maybe that'll be a little bit different conversation than we're used to having with some of these games. But looking forward to, you know, it's another one of these moments where I remember exactly where I was when I saw this happen. I'm sure you do too. The end of the game happens. So that'll be fun perspective, I think. So yeah, looking forward to it. Should be a good one. I would urge everyone to go ahead and head over to the post on the website, baseballamerica.com, and look for the link to this one. Like I said, it's a longer game, but I think it's a quicker watch here. I think it's a little bit snappier and won't be too much of a commitment for you to go ahead and jump into it.
It also has like an outstanding payoff. That's one thing we didn't touch on with South Carolina, Virginia, and I think we should real quick here because the payoff that's coming at the end of the Super Regional game is pretty significant. How do we feel about that Virginia season ending the way it did? That, I mean, they were so good. And yes, give South Carolina all the credit to, you know, go out and finish it off. But, you know, it's not like they hit a walk-off or anything. You know, Virginia throws the ball away. And, yeah. You know, it's a team that had been playing pretty crisp baseball all season long, obviously, and then that is their undoing and, you know, deep in extra innings in Omaha.
Yeah, it was that part was tough, for sure. And the fact that it's the same kid and the pitcher, back-to-back, you know, poor throws that end up being – I mean, it really does. Sometimes you say you'll say – you know, runs scored in large part thanks to errors. But I mean, that run really was just created by the errors. I mean, there's really no other way to put it. So yeah, you definitely felt for him in that moment. And it does kind of end up being a flat ending to what was otherwise, like you said, a game that was obviously tied. It was in the 13th inning. And it's funny. I mean, that was kind of, that was how Virginia got their run to tie it, was, you know, a misplay on the infield for South Carolina. So that was, you know, circling back to the kind of time and places, those are sometimes the kind of breaks you needed to create runs in 2011 college baseball. So in that way, I think it's fitting we got an ending that way. But certainly from a Virginia standpoint, it was, I'm sure, painful in the moment. And, you know, for fans anyway, only now maybe assuaged by the fact that they've had so much success after that and then won a national championship. But for those players, I'm sure it was just, it couldn't have been a more difficult way to lose that one.
Yeah, I think pretty much everything about this game is a perfect encapsulation of the time. Like, all the runs score, and like they had to get kind of helped along. The first run is because Michael Roth walks someone, and then he comes around to score.
He comes home on a double play, even like a hit. Yeah.
Yes. And you know, the final runs are products of errors, and in between there's some really great pitching, but yeah, it's I liked college baseball at the time, minus the bunting. Like, I'm not going to sit here and complain about well-pitched games, but yeah, this was not, you know, as much as I dislike Gorilla Ball, that this was a pendulum swing too far in the other direction for everyone, I think.
Certainly for me.
Yes, that is that you are far from alone in that. There are plenty of people that would much prefer we go back to Gorilla Ball before we go anywhere near what we got in the BBC era. But we will leave that behind next week. So we do have a different era of baseball again, even though the game will only be 7 years further along into time. One of the weird quirks of college baseball over the last decade is just how regimented or how segmented it's been because of various equipment changes, basically. But we will be back here with that on Friday. Joe and I will be joined by another guest who was a part of that game. That super regional game in 2018 between Florida and Auburn. Before then, we are continuing to go 2 times a week here on the Baseball America College podcast. So we'll be back here on Tuesday. Joe and I will be joined then by Kansas State coach Pete Hughes, assuming he doesn't get preempted by news again this week. Pete was supposed to join us this last week on the Baseball America College podcast. And then the Cape Cod League canceled its season, and we reformatted the show to acknowledge the Cape stuff, the Cape news, and then Pete graciously agreed to delay his appearance a week. So we will get Coach Hughes on here, talk some Kansas State. He has a very interesting background in coaching that we want to dive into. So we're gonna do all of that, and you can check that out. We'll be back here on Tuesday with that. And so if you are subscribed to the Baseball America podcast on your favorite podcasting app, be that Apple Podcast, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you are listening to podcasts, you can find us. Please subscribe. Please leave a rating or a review if you can. We greatly appreciate those as well. And then on Friday, of course, we'll be back here with another classic game. As we are continuing, that our plan is to continue that for the next couple months at least, going twice a week, and perhaps we'll reevaluate once the traditional college baseball season comes to an end at the end of June. But until then, we'll certainly keep this up for you guys. Beyond that, there's plenty of content over at baseballamerica.com. We had another coaching confidential question go up this week. I wrote a story about how volunteer assistant coaches are managing during the shutdown because they cannot hold camps or clinics. That really cuts into, that really cuts off the money that they're able to make to fund the positions. So that's definitely something that college baseball is going to have to reckon with if campuses remain shut down across the country into the summer, as many of them already have been. We'll have a new top 25 on the website on Monday. Joe, do we feel comfortable saying what this week's top 25 is?
I think so. I think we're pretty locked into it.
All right, Joe, what are we doing? What are we ranking 25 of? Remember, we are ranking 25 things every Monday from now until whenever. Because we miss ranking things. We don't get to rank 25 baseball teams a week anymore. So we're ranking other things. And Joe, what is it this week?
Yeah. So after back-to-back weeks of like fairly earnest rankings, like Golden Spikes, winning seasons, and then Cape League players of all time,
we dug into like research on those
for sure. Like that was earnest, like really caring about the specific, or like we had legitimate discussions about moving guys up like one or two slots. This week, however, even more important, ranking uniforms. So we are prepared to throw ourselves in the name of service journalism, throwing ourselves into all the various uniform combinations in college baseball, and we're going to try to spit out the 25 best. Understandably subjective, you know, what you view as best, but in our eyes, we're going to throw out what we feel are the 25 best uniforms in college baseball. And spoiler alert, you're going to hate it, just because I don't think there's any way that we could possibly rank 25 uniforms and have everybody like it. I think that's just one of those topics that everybody's going to have a different strong opinion, and that's just kind of the way it is.
I choose to be a more optimistic, Joe, and I think people are going to love this ranking because it's going to be objectively correct, and there will be no arguments.
Okay. All right.
With that in mind, if you guys have favorite uniforms, we are just looking for one single uniform, not sets. So if your favorite team has just one uniform, as long as they regularly wear it, I'm not looking for specific special uniforms, but if they only wear it, say, on Sundays, I don't care. As long as they wear it on every home Sunday, it's fine. Send those to us. You can find us on Twitter. I'm at Ted Cahill. Joe is at Joe Healy, BA. And again, just individual uniforms. So I don't care if, I mean, let's just say it, West Virginia might have the worst single uniform in the country. But if West, it's the digital camo one, in case you're confused, look it up. But they also might have one of the best. I'm not going to hold the digital camo against them. If they have one of the 25 best, we'll rank that. It's not going to get held back because they have a uniform that is objectively not good. Do not at me if you like the West Virginia digital camo uniform, please. So that's what we're looking for. Send us your suggestions and then check back over at baseballamerica.com on Monday for our ranking. And again, it'll be objectively correct, so you don't have to worry about it. We'll get them right. But if you have thoughts, feel free to send them to Joe and I. I am at Ted Cahill. Joe is at Joe Healy, BA. So that'll do it for us today. We'll be back here on Tuesday on the Baseball America College Podcast. Till then, I want to thank you guys for listening. Thank you again to Michael Roth for joining us on the podcast today. Thanks to Joe for joining me as always. I'm Teddy Cahill. We'll talk to you next week.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice cold reward. Medella, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medella is your reward. Medella, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.